Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Many of our best-known writers have their own compelling life stories. It's long been held that in a Hemingway, Oscar Wilde, Hunter S. Thompson kind of way, the extravagance of the artist's character feeds the art. The man who won the Man Booker Prize this year has now raised the bar for bad behavior. Britain's Sunday Telegraph describes him as a conniving bastard who got himself shot at by a neighbor in Mexico, nursed his gambling and cocaine addictions, left behind a trail of wronged women, and swindled an elderly American artist out of his home. Nice. Well, after this and a few years of therapy, Pierre Finley sits down, writes his first book, and wins one of the most prestigious literary awards. And, dear listener, you spend how much money on those graduate school creative writing seminars? So let's make this our question. Is the best art informed by life and not the classroom? Or is an author's autobiography irrelevant compared with the ability to tell a really good story? We're taking your calls this hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And my guest is joining us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. He's winner of this year's Booker, and he is Pierre Finley. Welcome to The Connection.
Hey, good morning.
Now, did I get the name right? I'm a little confused about this. It's Peter Finley sometimes when I read it, or Pierre, or then I look at my book, it's DBC Pierre. Are you confused?
We've got two names at work there.
All right.
My birth name is Peter Finley, and I've had the nickname, I actually had the nickname Dirty Pierre at the height of my misspent youth, and I've upgraded it to Dirty But Clean because I've changed and, trying to do good these days.
You're doing some good if you win the Booker Prize. I was looking at the list of previous winners and saw a bunch of others with initials. I said V.S. Naipaul and J.M. Coetzee and A.S. Bayat. And I thought that's why you called used the name D.B.C. Pierre. It was a Booker thing.
Not at all, although obviously it may have helped. And I've had that nickname for 14 years now.
Tell me a little bit about the start to your misspent youth that I referred to in such harsh terms at the beginning to the program. You were, what, 16 years old when you were first left on your own by your folks in Mexico?
Yes, that's right. Essentially, it's probably every parent's worst nightmare.
Well, every 16-year-old boy's greatest dream, too, no?
Well, it started out that way. I mean, it very, very quickly gets out of control. And essentially, I had a very plush upbringing. I was in Mexico City, which is a place where it's very easy to skirt the law. It's a pliable country because of this incredible contrast between rich and poor. So there wasn't much that you couldn't get away with there.
So a little bit about that then. You were swallowing Ritalin and smoking marijuana and driving cars too fast. What am I missing here?
Yeah. Well, there's a whole lot of anecdotes from in there, but that was essentially it. I mean, I was left with a house full of servants and cars, and basically within a few weeks, my friends had moved in, and we took it from there.
It was a sort of a start of a time for you of feeling that you might be a little bit invincible, I suspect.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. I mean, that already, I imagine, is an incredibly hormonal time. It's a time when you've got this testosterone peak happening, so you already feel like a little bit of a jock, even if you're not. And to get strung out of your head on the speedier drugs and to be surrounded by people who can't tell you anything is clearly a recipe for invincibility, at least in your own mind.
And you weren't at that time a particularly good student, I understand.
No, I was throughout my school career. I was a poor student. I'd actually suffered quite a protracted illness when I was about 8 years old. I had hepatitis. I had it very badly in Mexico City, and I must have spent the better part of a year in bed, learning to draw and paint and do things that didn't involve any exertion. And this had sort of had put me behind the eight ball in terms of school. My parents had a choice when I recovered of either putting me ahead with my age group or keeping me back a year and making me feel like a bit of a dunce. And they put me ahead, but I never actually caught that up.
And you weren't writing at that time, were you, Pierre?
Well, I wasn't, actually. I was, at the time, all I wanted to be was a cartoonist. And I was drawing feature films onto cash register rolls and making, I used to build these elaborate little cinemas out of shoe boxes. And I get however many yards of paper there are in a cash register roll. I would draw frames of a film and had a little mechanism whereby I could roll the film, you know, through this little screen and everything. And I was preoccupied more with the visual arts. And I've never really learned to hold a pen properly. I have my own strange grasp of a pen, and it made writing quite a hard exercise. I sort of, my hand cramps up fairly easily, so it wasn't the first thing I went to.
You were going to say, and I cut you off, that at the time when you were presented with this sort of cornucopia of childhood delights as a 16-year-old living with fast expats in Mexico, it was also a difficult time for you in family terms. What was going on then?
Well, this all came about because my father, who was working on UNDP-affiliated projects from a center in Mexico, a crop science center, he developed a brain tumor that year. And very suddenly, and he'd always been an incredibly fit and healthy man, and we'd had a very, very stable family life for as long as I could remember it. But he suddenly fell ill and had to spend a lot of time in New York being treated for that. And I understand he was actually employed out of New York, and the center was funded from there, so... Really, this is why he first disappeared, and it was strange because my mother travelled with him, and I did get to visit with him certain times. But other than that, I was many miles away, imagining what he was going through, and contemplating, the imminent breakup of the family in a way. So it was curious. I didn't think about that at the time, but. Retrospectively, that obviously was you could feel the carpet coming out from under your feet.
And the character in Vernon God Little suffers the same variable exchange of names. He's Vernon Gregory Little or Vernon Gonzalez Little or Vernon Gonad Little.
Sure.
throughout the book. How much of an autobiographical little cuss is he?
Well, there's... autobiographical energy in the book, definitely. As for the character, anything in him is deliberate. I sort of realized early on when I was starting to write this that there was an autobiographical energy going into it, and I contrived then to keep that away from the character as much as I could and maybe symbolize my story in the background somewhere. So I actually kill myself in this novel. I won't give away the keys to that, but you have to look at more than one character. There is a subplot where I take my own life. But Vernon certainly is informed by learnings and bits and pieces of experience that I had. And I probably started out with the old maxim, write what you know. And I certainly knew about trouble as an adolescent, so he's bound to benefit. Or be cursed by that.
I do want to spend some time talking about this book, because it's quite remarkable, both for its writing and its storytelling. I'm wondering, Pierre, if I can ask you to read something from the book. And I was talking with you about family, because there is this little bit where Vernon talks about knife turners, the learning.
Yes.
Do you have a copy of that anywhere at hand?
Yes, I can read that for you.
Would you? Go ahead.
Here we go. I'll tell you a learning. Knife turners like my old lady actually spend their waking hours connecting shit onto a humongous web, just like spiders. It's true. They take every word in the effing universe and index it back to your knife. In the end, it doesn't matter what words you say, you feel it on your blade. Like, wow, see that car? Well, it's the same blue as that jacket you threw up on at the Christmas show, remember? What I learned is that parents succeed by managing the database of your dumbness and your slime, ready for combat. They'll cut you down in a split effing second, make no mistake. Much quicker than you'd use the artillery you dream about. And I say, in idle moments, once the shine rubs off their kid, they start doing it just for effing kicks.
DBC Pierre, or Pierre Finley, reading from his Booker Prize-winning novel, Vernon God Little. This knife that follows poor Vernon around in the story, it's a little gruesome at times. What's the knife in your life?
Well, that's an interesting question. You put a spin on that question. I was about to explain that much of the novel and gets its black and white and its grotesque quality from my wanting to make a metaphor as well for adolescence, which is a time when things are either fantastically wonderful or they're black and grotesque and everyone is against you. Your parents are against you and things are hateful. There's that awful set of extremes that seems to fuel those early hormonal years. And in keeping with that, I was trying to identify those qualities that the adolescent feels are, you know, in his parents' armory of control. Because they do, parents obviously have to try and keep a handle on these extraordinary and increasingly willful creatures that are children. And
but the unique feature of your childhood is that a lot of that wasn't there.
No, in fact, I had an idyllic childhood, and things were very stable. I didn't hear my parents cuss ever. I remember my father when he was very seriously ill. I guess in an attempt to sort of bridge the gap and, have that first moment between men, he actually took me aside and told me a dirty joke. And I was shocked. I still am quite shocked, actually. It was the only time I've heard him cuss. But I could see it around me. I mean, I've always been an observer and lover of interaction and this extraordinary soup that we call humanity, with all these emotions and thoughts kind of jumbled together.
So the knife is something you observe rather than something that you project onto young Vernon?
Pretty much. Well, you feel it. I think, I wonder if we all don't have a bit of that. I mean, I certainly had the odd moment my folks would, bring something up at the inappropriate moment, or they'd embarrass you in front of somebody. And when you're a kid, you kind of wonder if they're not doing that to keep you quiet.
Or for kicks.
Or just for kicks. Well, it's worth speculating.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Pierre Finley is my guest this hour. We're talking about his first novel, Vernon God Little, which was chosen as the winner for this year's Men Booker Prize Connection. Listeners, we'll talk a little bit more about the life of the author and the life of the book itself and see how they cross over, and use that as a conversation where you can join us on just how much life informs art. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. John Kerry, chair of the Booker Judges, said when he was awarding the Booker Prize to Pierre Finley this year that Vernon God Little, the novel, is a coruscating black comedy reflecting our alarming fascination with modern America. We'll talk about the Judges' fascination with modern America when we continue our conversation a little bit later on. Connection listeners, a reminder for you, you're welcome to join us at 1-800-423-8255. Pierre Finley is my guest. He's author of the book Vernon God Little. And probably, Pierre, we should give our listeners just a little window in on what's going on in the novel. Small Texas town, Martirio, that's Spanish for martyrdom, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Just an accident, I guess.
An accident, the name,
you say. Yeah.
No, nothing's accidental in there.
And Vernon's friend, Jesus, has just gunned down 16 of his classmates. And when we first meet him, he is just in the process of finding out that he's about to be stuck with the responsibility for all these deaths. Fair enough?
Yes, that's it. He gets basically the novel begins after this massacre, a few days after. The local police are trying to put together bits and pieces of evidence and information, and the second most underdoggy kid in that class is Vernon Little, and he's the only one left, and he gets sucked into this vortex of increasing blame, and basically spends the novel getting into that and trying to get back out.
You know, a tremendous part of the book is the way that the characters in Martirio choose to see themselves and wish to see themselves as part of the media circus that inevitably surrounds a story like this in a town like this. There's a character, Lally, who becomes fairly key here, and a television reporter, but not really a television reporter.
Yeah, he's an imposter. He's the opportunist. Without giving too much of the plot away, he's there trying to spin gold from the tragedy, and he has quite some success with it.
You know that place in the book where you actually it's not a transcription, but it's a version of Lally's first television report about poor Vernon Little?
Yes.
I think it's on page 55. I wonder if I could get you to take us through that, because I think it lets people in a little bit on just exactly what's going on.
Okay. Yeah, this is Lally in his first TV report from the scene of Vernon Little's house. To his neighbors, Vernon Gregory Little seemed a normal, if somewhat awkward, teenager, a boy who wouldn't attract attention walking any downtown street. That is, until today. Lush pictures fill the screen of crime scene tape dancing under a blackened sky, body bags punctuating drag marks of blood, moist ladies howling pizza cheese bungees of spit. Then, a school photo of me, grinning. "I definitely saw changes in the boy," says George Porcorny. You can see her cigarettes hidden behind the fruit salad plant on the breakfast bar at home. His shoes got more aggressive. He insisted on one of those skinhead haircuts. "I know," says Betty in back. Cut to Leona Dunt. Her handbag needs to be a yard taller for how big the word Gucci is written on it. "Wow, but he seemed like such a regular kid." Black, disordered xylophone music joins the soundtrack as the camera bumps up the hallway to my room. Lally stops by my bed to face the camera. Vernon Little was described to me as something of a loner, a boy with few close friends, given more to playing on his computer and reading. The camera takes a vicious dive into the laundry pile by the bed. Out comes the lingerie catalog. But we find no Steinbeck, no Hemingway in Vernon Little's private library. In fact, his literary tastes run only to this. Pages flap across the screen. Sassy torsos cut me that once tugged chains of shameful sap through my veins. Then we hit page 67. Flapping stops. "An innocent prop?" asks Lally. "Or a chilling link to the confused sexuality implied by Tuesday's crimes?" Twisted violins join the xylophone. The shot pans over my computer screen to the file marked Homework. Click. Cue the amputee sex pictures I saved for old Silas Ben. "Well, golly," says Mom, "I had no idea." Lally sits beside her on my bed, cranking his brow into a sympathetic A-frame. "As Vernon's mother, would it now be fair to number you among the victims of this tragedy?" "Well, I guess I am a victim. I really guess so." "Yet you maintain Vernon's innocence." "Excuse me." "Oh, God. A child is always innocent to his mother. Well, even murderers are loved by their families, you know."
D.B.C. Pierre, a.k.a. Pierre Finley, from reading from Vernon God Little. It's a line that you come back to a couple of times in the book. Even murderers are loved by their families, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those lovely, innocent things that mothers will say that completely indict you on the spot.
Not very helpful.
And you wonder, well, as a kid, you wonder how innocent a lot of that is. I guess that gets back to the knife, but...
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Lexington, Massachusetts. Mark's joining us on the line. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a question for the author. Could you say a few words about the final events of the book? Did they really happen, or is it Vernon's wishful thinking?
Do you mean... Are you talking about the very...
Did he really get a pardon, or... Anyway...
Yeah,
no,
I'm not.
Really
not
happen?
Well, let me tell you that it's ambiguous. I can't talk about the ending of the book because it will spoil it for anyone that wants to read it. But I can tell you that in Europe, in southern Europe, the feeling is that he doesn't. And in Northern Europe, the feeling is that he does. I know that's sort of cryptic, but hopefully you'll get that.
Okay. Is the title of the book related to my question?
What, to whether or not Vernon wishes that he was God as opposed to Vernon Greg Little?
Yeah, so the...
You're being a little oblique here, Mark. I need you to ask what you're wondering about this book.
No, I mean, no, I explained that I was wondering whether it was the intention of the author to make it ambiguous, and he did say he wanted it to be ambiguous.
I've got you, okay.
And then the last incarnation of his middle name, is it just the fact that he may cause this event or not?
Yeah. That is it's related to his redemption and to the lecture given to him by that man in prison.
Now, does he see himself as a martyr, Pierre?
Vern, well, he has. There is a self pity running through it, especially. You'll notice that his voice changes some way through the novel. It starts out as a rollicking and lurid and ridiculous farce about all these grotesques in this festering little town, and then some way through it gets serious. The blame starts to stick. More real life events come into it, and Vernon starts to be weighed under that increasingly. So as following on from that, the thing does change tone toward the end of the novel.
Talk to me a little bit more about these grotesques, though, because you've an interesting perspective on America. You know it as so many other people in the world do through what it projects out in television. But then when you're a kid in Mexico, your buddies are expat Americans, it's in many ways the promised land. And you're kind of caught, I think. Is it as grotesque as you paint it or not?
Well, here's the key to the novel, but this is more about impressions of America, and it's I wanted to construct something. I mean, obviously it's an immensely complex country to get to the bottom of. It seems as though everyone in the world is now trying to do that, and the day somebody sits down in the world to form an opinion or an impression of America, the things they have generally to go on are the very sensational edges of news reports, where somebody's won $140 million in the New York State lottery, or they've killed 15 people, in a fast food restaurant, or the stuff that's actually sold out of the country, Jerry Springer and all these kind of shows. And it's interesting that there is a certain, I mean, I know it'd be a hard country to describe. But there just came a point when it fascinated me. And bear in mind, too, this was I wrote the first draft of this in 1999, so it was before the tone of world relations changed most recently. But it just occurred to me what a fascinating proposition it was that here 99% of the world was in some way touched by America or American information, and yet would never get to come here and taste it. They would have to form some kind of impression from these scraps of media that are sold to them.
So when you glue together the fact that this little kid's being accused of killing 16 or so odd classmates, and his mother's main concern is whether or not her brand-new side-by-side refrigerator is going to be delivered that afternoon. This is part of the cut-and-paste of images that you're saying America actually appears to be from people watching from outside.
Yes, very much so. It's really these scraps of information. I mean, you know, there never has been any sort of a clip or a show about that. You know, 95% of America that gets up and goes to work every morning and leads a reasonable life. The market depends on human interest, and it means that only the sensational stuff gets out. And it seemed a fascinating proposition for me to build a world that was a patchwork that took all of those clips, all of those lurid headlines, back to back. And then to try and put a reasonable mind, put a kid in the middle of it and see if he would sink or swim.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Worcester, Massachusetts now. John's joining us. Hi, John, go ahead.
Hello. I would like to ask the gentleman, in the passage from the novel that was read, the main character mentioned the novelists and novels, Steinbeck, Hemingway, etc., that he hadn't read. I was wondering what the gentleman's would consider his own literary influences, maybe both historical and or contemporary. Then boil it down to, I guess, what does he read now, and maybe what kind of an audience is he trying to reach? What tradition does he see himself, fictional tradition does he see himself coming out of?
Well, there's a mouthful for you.
I tell you what. Yeah. Well, thanks, John. I've never thought about any of that, so it's I can make it up on the spot. I'm not incredibly well read, to be honest. I've always loved reading. I'm a reasonably slow reader, obviously I was touched by some American readings when I was growing up. But you know, the last few years I've read mostly nonfiction and textbooks and things like that. I mean, my villainous youth meant that I didn't actually get to college. And I still have many, many gaps that arouse curiosity in me. So it's hard to point a finger, you know. I know I was touched as a kid by Miller's Death of a Salesman. And in fact, there's a point in this novel where Vernon makes a passing tribute to that. And that sort of had an ironic place in my life, the way it went later. Kerouac wrote the best thing I'd read about Mexico. I just painted an incredible impression with a few words, and I was very impressed by that growing up. So really, I mean, this is the first year that I've been published, and suddenly I have a group around me of reliable people to recommend me works, and so I'm now trying to fill in a back catalogue.
You realize that there are graduate students banging their heads on their desks all around the country.
Are they?
Wondering why they're studying when they could probably have just gone out and knocked back a couple of quick shots of tequila and got very stoned and missed 10 years of their life and then written a Booker Prize-winning novel. I mean, there is a sense in the way that you present it, and I mean this in the most complimentary way, a sort of exuberant burst of word on the page. And I don't... I don't have much of an idea, having read it, whether or not that's what happened or whether or not there was a fairly careful editing process that came after some wildly scrawled first draft.
Oh, very much so. I grew to love editing. In fact, if there was a problem with the novel, and if there are still bits that seem patchy, it will be due to my over-editing. I wrote the first draft of this in 5 weeks flat, and basically had the voice of the kid, and then had to go back and spend 18 months turning it into a story and trying to smooth it out. And in the course of that, I discovered that with each edit and every pass that I made through the book, the thing would just tighten up a little bit more and get a little bit closer to what I could feel, because in the end of the day, I was only trying to describe feelings and impressions of my own, and it's tricky.
I haven't dwelt this hour that much on the other sort of details of your life. The Evening Standard, in its review of you, talks about you as a slimy con man, betraying your close friend, fleecing hundreds of thousands from former friends, using the money to feed cocaine and gambling habits, and that seems to sort of sketch in those years from when you grew up in Mexico and before you went into therapy prior to the book. Is that reasonable or not?
Well, it's a longer story. You know, I have to take the rap for it, in essence. And the problem here is that if I deviated from a decent course in life in my teens, I was successful in keeping that at bay until my 20s, my mid-20s or so.
So we've just then, like 30 or 40 seconds before we have to go to a break. Was the writing of the book part of the either rehabilitation or redemption of Pierre Finley?
Yes, it certainly was, because those energies are like rocket fuel. And I had to start treating it in art before I could treat it in life and move into some kind of future.
Did you ever surprise yourself that you had the talent to write what you did when you finally sat down to write?
Now it's a bit of a mind boggler. When I sat down, I didn't know what I had, and I couldn't relate it to anything I'd seen before, so it was tricky.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, my guest this hour, Pierre Finley. We're talking about the way that your life affects the art that you produce and what you make of a life that produces a Man Booker Prize winner of the caliber of Vernon God Little. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Pierre Finley, author of Vernon God Little, this year's winner of the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. And our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Shannon now. He's calling in from Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Shannon. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, Dick, you asked my question.
Oh, no.
But I have a second part question. That it is sort of a redemption to have published this book or written and published this book. Have you started to make amends? And I want to say I haven't read the book yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. It's right up my alley.
By making amends, do you mean with the prize money?
Yeah, either with the prize money, or how does the book, just the writing of the book, factor into it?
Go ahead, Pierre.
Right. Well, in my mind, the writing of the book really is more about me. I mean, in terms of making amends with my past, I come out of it with a lot of debt, and that, you know, when I sat down to write, I quickly realized that I wasn't going to write anything financially viable. And to be honest, if you'd seen me 3 or more years ago when this was happening, and all these words on the page, it was clear that wasn't going to be a mainstream kind of book. Curiously, now the Times, in an ironic twist, the Times have sort of come up to give it some possibility of financial redemption. But no, it was more about resolving myself, and you just come to a point where you have to, if you're not going to hang yourself or shoot yourself, then the only logical thing is to move forward and do what you can. And all I had really in life was art. I don't have any other sort of professional calling, so I had to go for it in that respect. On a physical level, Obviously, I've now been able to turn over these prize winnings and make a start on the debts that I was left, and that'll never make up for all of these years that have been lost and the original hurt. But you know, hopefully, can go some way towards filling in a hole.
There is a sort of glee, though, with which the media has seized on the misbegotten bits of your past that I wonder if you see it as kind of romanticizing you in the, you know, oh, Hemingway drank like a fish and wasn't he just such a great guy for that? In retrospect, he probably wasn't a particularly pleasant person to hang around when he was like that. What's your feeling about the way it gets romanticized?
Yeah, well, that precisely that point has been on my mind. I mean, this is, let me say, we're 2 weeks into this new world. I've gone through the little door like Alice in Wonderland, and it's, I think today's the second week anniversary of the Booker Prize and all of that. And it is a danger. I'll say to you now that, you know, we shouldn't romanticize or glorify my misdoings at very least, because they're pathetic and weak and didn't and don't have an edge of glory to them. I mean, seriously, we're talking about hurting people and breaching trusts, and by definition, these were good people as well to give trust. So it's not something like not something that should be romanticized in my mind.
It's funny because as I hear you describe that, I'm thinking of a fact which popped out on three or four or five articles that I read about you and your book in advance of this interview. And almost every single one of them mentioned the point at your life when you plucked a half-eaten hot dog out of a dumpster, as if this was a way of registering just how low the man had gone before he rises as high as he rises. And in a way, it's a mirror of what's happening in the book, too. It's part of what's going on in the book, is it not?
It's interesting that you identify that. There is an energy in the book which now has taken on an extraordinary and quite ironic similarity. I mean, obviously the energy of trouble and guilt that surrounds the first part of the book is something I was already well familiar, but there are ironies emerging even as we speak that give it a certain, almost a prophetic touch. So it makes me want to stay in a darkened room and not emerge until things get back to normal.
Our number is 1-800-423-TALK to Carlisle, Massachusetts now. Sharon's on the line. Hi, Sharon.
Hi there. My question actually dovetails nicely with the last comment that the author just made. What I was wondering is what it feels like to have now sort of publicized what was a very personal self-discovery by turning to the art as your first attempt at, you know, kind of rediscovering parts of yourself or, you know, moving into a deeper understanding of yourself, and then come to find that there are these parallels and mirrors and ironies that are now quite public and exposed.
That's a curious one. I'll tell you the bottom line answer to that is that it doesn't really matter. There's nothing quite as hard and prickly as facing yourself in any of these matters. So really, whether or not anyone else knows is hypothetical. I don't feel it too strongly. It's not like if you were somebody who had a sense of pride or a reputation or something that they relied upon, then that could make a difference. But you know, I didn't, and I've long disabused myself of any pride, really.
But what would make you want to stay in that dark place until things return to normal?
Right. Well, without giving the whole story of the book away, it's just that there are I'm trying, as I speak to you, I'm trying to pick one out of the air, but there are interesting parallels with the book and with the energy of the book that that come to me sort of every day. I mean, in a curious way, it's and they have been since the thing was published. It's curious. For instance, I was very poor before this was published, and I was living in England, which is quite an expensive place. And at the moment that I had any kind of a prospect of an income, immediately I saw that I had to start paying rent, and England became too expensive a place for me to stay. And I actually went to a very, very beautiful corner of Ireland where I now live, and where the people have been very graciously taken me in. But curiously, think about this. I'm a city boy, and I've written a book about a very a sweltering small town, you know, quite remote from anywhere else. And without even thinking about it, the moment this story was published, I moved to a sweltering small town that is quite remote. And it's there are little things like that along the way here. It's clearly life is interwoven with art, and there's a phenomenal kismet around the you know, around the writing of the book. Had all sorts of strange strange coincidences and things as well. So it's when I say I want to hide away, it's just that there's a certain power to all of this, because I wouldn't, to be honest, when I wrote some of the lines in this book, the Booker Prize wasn't the first thing that came to mind. And I can't read, you know, on public radio, I can't tell you what those lines are, but you can well guess.
Sharon, thanks for your call. There is a conclusion that Vernon draws at one point, I guess about halfway through the book, when he says you can only... What did he say? You can only really be yourself when you have nothing left to lose. See, that's a learning I made. That's more than just Vernon Godlittle speaking there.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Having nothing to lose is a very powerful position. And I've lost it now. So, you know, there was a time when smoking and alcohol were the very, very least of my problems. And now suddenly... with some kind of horizon before me, I have to start addressing, you know, cigarettes and things that were really on the very bottom of the list. So, it's a curious climb back into life, hopefully, for me.
How much of it is fate? How much of where you are now is fate?
Well, you know, you don't know. I don't know. Life plays curious tricks. And depending if you're, you know, if you're a scientist or artist, you probably get a different take on that. I mean, I know that the coincidence and the things that we perceive as coincidence is often explainable quite mathematically. But at the same time, you know, we do live in a world that that has certain marking posts along the way of it. Be they omens or little signs that even if we see them retrospectively, seem to have pointed towards something. And I've, as another thing Vernon learns, is that when you're in deep trouble, you tend to get suspicious. And
what do you mean by a marking post along the way?
Well, things, a sign, you know, a signpost along life's road. It seems to me if you approach things with sensitivity, which is something I neglected to do in my youth, and now probably do too much of, but if you stay awake and cautious and work from a position of doubt in life, which I sort of now think is the only sensible default, certain signs and pointers do seem to become apparent, and whether or not they are self-generated or they exist actually in nature and there is some kind of a fate, well, that's something that I'll never know. But there are some extraordinary coincidences and pointers. I'll tell you, the publisher of this book in America has a favorite number, which is 27. And he came to the Booker Prize event in London a couple of weeks ago, and he had a day that seemed replete with 27s. It seemed as though all sorts of different occasions when any random number could have appeared, 27 would have appeared. And he said to me later, he said, when he sat down before the announcement and saw that he'd been sat at table 27, he knew we'd won it. And just stuff like that I'm talking about, which is on the one hand, clinically that is an obsessive sort of a madness, I guess. And on the other hand, their life is full of delicate signs, but I don't know whether they come from us or from outside.
But on your way down or on your way back up, where does religion fit in? Because it's throughout the book, but it's never analyzed. It's simply presented.
Yeah, religion. See, I'm a bit pantheistic. I tend to believe everything now. I don't have a formal religious teaching that I follow, but I've become certainly more interested in it. And I have to say, if I can analogize, it seems like if you took, say, the sun or an incredibly bright light and put it in a colander so that a shaft of light shone through each of the holes, that for me would analogize the religious thing. I do feel that there is an energy which can be followed positively or negatively, and each little shaft of light probably leads to the same source for me. So it's strange. I've become very sensitive to certainly different feelings and the way different things appear to work, but without actually taking a formal religious stance on it.
2 weeks since the Booker, your feet don't sound like they're quite on the ground.
No, they're certainly not. No, they're certainly not.
Pierre, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Pierre Finley, author of Vernon God Little, which is this year's winner of the Man Booker Prize for fiction. Thanks to Paul Lancour at KQED for his assistance with the program today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.